We know that Antony Blinken, Janet Yellen, Olaf Scholz have visited China and they tried to convince Chinese not to help Russia. We had this new visit of Xi to Europe and in which he visited France and then went to Serbia and Hungary. I think the main visits were to Hungary and Serbia. In your opinion, if some of these European countries join BRICS, what would that mean for these new changes that are happening in the world?
Well, I think these new changes, as you put them, are the crucial part of the story. And I wouldn't even attach all that much importance to this country or that country leaning this way or that. I think take a step back and see the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is this. Once upon a time, after 1945, there was one dominant economic power, the United States. And it built an alliance with the former dominant powers, and that was Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Europe, Western Europe. And for most of the last 75 years, the United States and its allies, whom we can refer to now as the G7, that is the United States, Canada, Japan, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy. These seven are what was dominant for most of the 75 years. Over the last generation, the last 20, 25 years, that situation changed with the rise, the spectacular rise of China from being the largest country by population and one of the poorest on this earth. It achieved an economic rate of growth never seen before. Again, I remind everyone, for the last 25 or 30 years, the growth of GDP in China has been 6 to 9%, which is 2 to 3 times what it was in the United States, and greater than in 99% of the rest of the world. China became a modern powerhouse economic unit. Then, a few years ago, it began very wisely to build up alliances very carefully with everyone and anyone it could find willing to do so. And so now we have the BRICS, which is China and its allies, the parallel to the United States and its allies. But they call it the BRICS on the one hand and the G7 on the other. Now the BRICS had initially five countries: China, India, Russia, South Africa, and Brazil. And now it has another six, if I'm keeping score. So it's China plus 11, or China, including China, 11 countries. The important thing is that this alliance of China and the others is now a larger, by GDP, a larger economic unit than the G7. They were equal back in 2020, and they have since diverged, with the BRICS growing much faster relative to the G7, which are barely growing at all. This changes everything. Every country on earth, big ones, small ones, have no choice but to react to this changed world economy. You know, where your future is, if you export, you want to be able to export to both of them. But if you have to choose, you're going to go with the one that is larger and growing faster, because it would be stupid not to do that. Okay? That gives China enormous power. If you want to import from those countries, same reason. If you want to borrow money, if you want to get investments, whatever you want, you are now at least going to talk to the BRICS people alongside talking to the G7. In fact, you will try, if you're big enough, to play them off against one another. Right now, Saudi Arabia is busy doing that, and other countries do it. I don't mean to pick on the Saudis. They're not the only one. Everybody is trying to recalibrate what they're going to do. And they're going to change. And they're going to be people who go to one and then go to the other one because of the reaction of the two to the competition between them. At this point, it's impossible not to make adjustments. We are living through the adjustments. And that process of adjustment is also the dominant engine of change in the United States too, because it too has to adjust. The problem in the United States, as I've talked to you about it before, is that there's an immense need here to deny what is going on. Every empire's decline saw many of the people in the country that's declining, whose empire is declining, there were always large groups of people who refused to see it, who refused to understand it, who refused to take it into account. Let me give you just one example of the terrible miscalculation you can make if you don't think honestly about it. The United States and Britain clearly decided that there was a reasonable chance that they could quickly defeat Russia if Russia intervened in the plans they had to bring Ukraine into NATO and the European Union. Why? Because they saw on one hand a 10-year developed army in Ukraine that the West had equipped and trained and mobilized. The Ukrainians could never have done that themselves. And the weapons they use, as everybody now knows, are overwhelmingly either old Soviet-era weapons left in Ukraine or Western weapons. Ukraine itself, very little. Some, but very little. Okay. The miscalculation. They thought they would be fighting Russia. But the answer is they weren't fighting Russia. They were fighting BRICS. Russia turned when they could not sell oil and gas because of the sanctions levied by the United States with Europe going along. They thought they had Russia destroyed. Russia is an economy that depends heavily on the export of oil and gas. If they couldn't export it to their conventional markets, they were finished. Yeah, this is because you didn't understand BRICS. BRICS bought the oil and gas, to make a complicated story very simple. I'm oversimplifying, but it's the same basic point. And the irony is, it proved to the BRICS, it proved to them how important they are to one another. It's not just Russia learned. Russia learned what it could get from India and China, but India and China and Brazil, they also learned what they can get from one another. It changes all of their calculations, including whether or not to go to war. And there aren't any more important calculations than that. So being in a state of denial about your decline leads you to make terrible mistakes. The war in Ukraine is being lost by the Ukrainians more today than ever before. Let me take another example. At least the last 50 years, it has been Western policy to try to separate Russia from China for obvious geopolitical reasons. And yet here we are, and the alliance between them is stronger and closer than ever. At the very least, Western policy of keeping them apart has been a disaster. They didn't understand, the West didn't understand how to do what they said was a chief foreign policy goal. Okay, that's another mistake. Moreover, the alliance is stronger now, not just the alliance Russia-China, but the participation of India. I mean, I don't know if you caught it, but a day or two ago, Iran and India signed agreements to do all kinds of things. That means Iran, too, is now having help from BRICS. Important. It already had help from Russia, we know, but now from India. Give you another idea. Inside India, there's now a debate, and it has to do with the fight in the Middle East. Israel does not want Palestinians anymore to be anywhere near them. So they have revoked the license of about 100,000 Palestinians doing construction work in Israel. They went to India trying to make a deal with Modi in India to send 100,000 Indian workers to replace the Palestinian workers in Israel. Okay? The Modi government is thinking about it because there's money in it. But there's an enormous movement now inside India, led by the trade unions, against all of this. And so the real decision will be, how does the rest of the BRICS see this? Because this is a kind of favoring of Israel against Palestinians. All right. All of these calculations, where anywhere in the world, are changing. If you pay attention, you'll notice that recently a number of Central African countries have pushed the United States out. Niger, most recently. Well, who are they bringing in? Russia. Well, why Russia? Because they want access to the BRICS also, and Russia is going to help them do that. African countries couldn't dare do that before. If they were like Niger, a French colonial, they went to Paris and worked something out. And that required them to accept French troops on their soil, etc. The world is changing radically. And it's affecting everything. And I think it's more important that people understand that process than to get too attached to each little moment in that process. There will be steps forward and steps backward. There will be countries that join BRICS and then leave and go to the G7, vice versa. It's not well known, but 2 or 3 years ago, the French actually made some effort to join BRICS. So there's a European country that's already done it. They were rejected, by the way, by BRICS. Interesting phenomena. So I think you're watching a change. And if I may, let me take it over because it affects other issues. When Xi went to Europe and visited with France, Serbia, and Hungary, he was building a relationship with countries that, at least Serbia and Hungary, that already have elaborate links with Russia and through that with BRICS. He went to visit France because of the peculiar politics in France, which make it necessary for French leaders to show that they are independent of the United States, Britain, and Germany. They aren't. And everybody who's involved knows they aren't. But it is necessary to demonstrate in France that you are independent in the manner of Charles de Gaulle once upon a time. It's the anxiety of people who are dependent that they need to act out that they are not dependent. That's why, and by the way, it's necessary for Mr. Macron, therefore, periodically to do something nobody else is doing, because that's another way of showing I'm independent. So the other day, he did that crazy business with sending NATO troops to Ukraine, only for everybody else to say, no, 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 no. It's the same thing. Now he invites Xi. Nobody else invites Xi. He invites Xi. He talks to Xi. They have nothing to say to each other. And it is humorous for a spokesperson in Paris to have said something about separating Russia from China. They are a 100% failure at that. Mr. Xi is closer to Mr. Putin than ever before. Both of them say so. Everything we see reinforces it. And Mr. Macron is rightly counting on the mass media in France to take all that seriously, the way the media in America takes seriously what Mr. Biden and what Mr. Trump say, when the whole rest of the world cannot believe it. So that's my reaction to what. And when Blinken or Yellen go to China, it is hilariously absurd what they do. This effort, which they announce that they are urging China to change its ways. China in the last 35 or 30 years has been the most successful economic growth story ever. Why would they change what has worked for them? The only reason Blinken and Yellen are making trips every few weeks to China is because of the success of their system. To go to say to people whose success is what brings you there, you shouldn't do that, that's too stupid. All it does is make the world realize how isolated, how out of touch, how maniacal. Even if they didn't know that Americans shoot each other in a way that doesn't happen on any other country, that Americans overdose on fatal drugs on a scale we don't see in other countries. Even when people see that, then to hear the political leaders talk in this strange way, it's bizarre. You know, to have the American Navy 10,000 miles away in the South China Sea arguing over the status of what both sides agree is part of China, it's really bizarre. It's like the desperate efforts of a dying giant to wave his hands around to give the others the impression of power and influence when you don't have it anymore. Look, the desperate problem with Ukraine is that the United States is being defeated and the whole world sees it. The GDP of the United States is, I don't know, 14, 15 times the GDP of Russia. And we're losing the war. What? What? The West is explaining it cannot give Ukraine more arms because it doesn't have any more. It can give them money, but it's going to take time to produce the weapon. My God, a country 14, 15 times bigger than Russia, and I'm not speaking of Europe, you add Europe, it's 20 times the size of Russia, Western Europe and America versus Russia. I mean, what are you doing? Well, it's the BRICS, of course, that help Russia. Yeah, but then you have to understand, what are you saying? You're saying that the BRICS and Russia are defeating the G7. And the whole world is seeing it. And whatever happens in the Middle East is not going to change what we're seeing on the much larger world scale. There's 7 million Israelis and another 7 million Palestinians. That's not a very large part of this world. And even the United States population is 4.5% of the world. And all we're seeing, if you wanted a shorthand way of seeing it, is that the world is adjusting to the United States becoming 4.5% of it, not the dominant colossus that it was at the end of World War II. And that process now looks, you never know for sure, but it looks irreversible. That's why Xi can also go and have very quiet conversations in Serbia, in Hungary, because to be crude, time is on his side. Time has worked for him for the last 35 years. If he can avoid a nuclear war, he'll win, because he already is. And the United States, which needs to avoid a nuclear war for the same reasons, is watching a process that is shrinking its footprint, that is reducing its power. It is already, but it will continue to be the most important shaper of what happens. Let me give you another example, because it's in the news today. Today, the United States government quadrupled the tariff on Chinese electric vehicles. It also raised tariffs on computer chips and batteries and solar panels and other things. Okay, you will now have to pay a 100% tariff if you want to bring an electric truck or an electric car from China to the United States. What will that do? Well, it's protection for the producers of electric cars and trucks inside the United States. They will now no longer face any risk of Chinese competition. They cannot equal, the Chinese dominate in the world already in batteries and electric cars and trucks. They produce a better quality at a lower price than anybody else. So the rest of the world is adjusting. All over the rest of the world, people are buying cheap Chinese electric cars and trucks. And if you're a company that needs cars and trucks, which most companies do, well, then you won't have to raise your prices because you're able to get these things cheaply. In contrast, anyone who buys in the United States anything will have to pay higher prices because American electric vehicle producers will be able to charge very high prices because of the tariff that protects them. Since they don't have to collect the tariff, you know, they can produce a 25, give you an example. Suppose the Chinese truck and it costs $20,000. Okay. The Americans, knowing that that truck cost $20,000 to pay the Chinese who made it, plus another $20,000 tariff to Uncle Sam, that it will cost $40,000 to buy the Chinese truck, they will price their trucks at $38, competitive with $40, but a big fat profit for them. But that means every producer in the United States who needs trucks will have to pay $38. Whereas his competitor around the world will only have to pay the $20 that the China, you understand? This is a terrible thing for the United States. But Mr. Biden has to do it to run for office. Mr. Biden has to do it to pander to the automobile companies here who will make a big profit. It reminds me of earlier this week, the Washington Post reported a meeting between Donald Trump, running for office, and oil company executives. Mr. Trump said, I need $1 billion to win the presidency. But if I win, I will cancel all the subsidies that Biden has given to the electric vehicle industry. And the oil executives smiled, realizing that if you slow down or cancel electric, we will all have to buy oil and gas for our vehicles. Yeah, we will. But everywhere else in the world, they won't. And that will hurt. That will cause an inflationary burst in this country. As the price of trucks and automobiles goes up, so will everything else. And for those of you that care about the climate, we know that electric cars are less polluting than oil and gas cars. So we need to convert quickly. We have Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden competing to please the car and truck and oil industries, and therefore sacrifice the speed at which we need to, at a time of climate catastrophe. That shows you that the Republicans and Democrats could care less about this. And here's the final thing that all of this shows. Everything is justified in our political system by jobs. No matter what politician is selling out to what capitalist industry, it's always for jobs. I am doing this for jobs. If you actually cared about jobs long ago, you would have developed a government program to give everybody who doesn't have a job in the private sector a job in the public sector. That's what we did in the 1930s. Here in the United States, 15 million public jobs were created for the unemployed. We could do it again. Then we would take care of jobs, and you wouldn't have to make stupid decisions about automobiles to save jobs. It's a fakery, this talk about jobs. It is always done by people who have failed to solve the job problem. So they're now going to protect. And all of this are signs, again, of the relative decline of the G7. I appeal to all of you watching. Keep that in your mind. It'll help you understand what's going on far better than any other framework to understand daily news and events.
I don't know if you listen to what John Mearsheimer is saying. One of the things that is so crucial in his talk is this falling empire and rising empire and this transition between these empires. He says that it's not going to be peaceful. We're going to have a lot of fight, a lot of blood.
Well, I admire and I learn from John Mearsheimer. He is what's called a realist in political theory or political science. And he understands a good bit about clashing powers, superpowers, big powers, little powers, and so on. But if you listen to him, you will also notice, or at least I do, that he has little or no interest in the economics of what's going on. It's all about power, about security, about prestige, about alliances among powers. All of that is very interesting, very important. But I look at the same issues from the standpoint of the economic systems going on inside each of these powers. And I begin with the assumption, which I get from history, that whatever power politics is being pursued by this leader, that leader, and so on, Putin or Biden or Cameron or anyone, is a policy that depends on, even though it doesn't admit it, on the economic realities of the underlying society. What Mr. Putin wants to do is not the same as what he can do. He may hold them both in his head. He may be a man full of plans and desires and goals, but he's also a functioning politician who has to maintain a kind of social complexity of his society, which depends in good measure on its economics. So does he want to build an alliance with Russia, China and India? Yeah. But can he? Can he sell oil and gas at a price that makes it worthwhile for India and China to buy it? And at the same time, saves him from the sanctions that the West is using? Well, he could. What he wanted to do and what he could do worked out. But it is often not the case. When the price of oil drops, Mr. Putin has to adjust. He can't just go ahead. All right, now let me make the next logical point. It's not only a question of the up and down of the oil price or of this. What about the more basic question? Is your economic system secure? Why do I ask it and what do I mean? What I mean is, are the people caught up in your system happy with it? Are they content? Or are they bitter and angry and looking maybe for a different system? Let me use the United States as an example. I am impressed over the last 10 years, that here inside the United States, the conversation has changed dramatically. 10 years ago, almost nobody questioned the capitalist system. It was simply assumed that is the way the world works, that is the way the world always has worked. That is the way the world will work. It's the best system so far, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. 10 years later, there's an enormous part of the population that is questioning. At this point, I wouldn't go, it's questioning. Capitalism isn't universally celebrated. There's a sizable group of people who put down on public polls, I prefer socialism. I understand what they mean by socialism is all over the place. But capitalism as a system is not so secure as it was. Now follow the logic. Suppose the problems of American society deepen. Suppose Mr. Trump is elected and the country really begins to split, because his notion is to take it in what others call a fascistic direction, and that will be a problem for all the people who don't want to go in a fascistic direction, etc. Well, here's what can happen, and it has happened historically before. The people's willingness to engage in power politics, in other words, to follow their leaders in thinking that the great problem is Russia or China or Britain or where, that could be pushed aside because the great problem might become capitalism and the desire of people to have a different system, to not have employers and employees, to have production organized as a democratic community. One person, one vote. Not some people, employers, and other employees. A movement to replace capitalism with worker cooperatives, for example, could very quickly become the dominant concern of the people. And they're going to say to you, you may want us to fight a war against another country, but we're not going to do that We have a war to fight here at home. It's a war against capitalism and those who support it by those of us who can do better, feel that we can do better than capitalism and want to go beyond it. At that point, all of the calculations, the power calculations that John Mearsheimer analyzes and studies and writes so interestingly about, get pushed aside historically in favor of a whole nother conflict that is more urgent. Let me put the final way of putting this. I would argue that a good, and Mearsheimer doesn't do this, but I would, based on what I just told you, that I think there's always a war, which I would call a class war, going on between the employers and the employees, just as there was always a war between the masters and the slaves, between the lords and the serfs, between the employer. Now, sometimes it's very muted. It's only anger over how long you can take your lunch break in the middle of the day. But at other times, it blows up. We know that. Strikes, unionization drives, the way we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years at Starbucks and Amazon and all over the place. We have a labor movement and a critique of capitalism movement that are growing together at the same time. Now, here comes the argument. I think power politics is in part a deliberate deflection of the class struggle at home into a nation struggle on the world scene. Doesn't mean it isn't real. It is real. But it is partly shaped as a distraction from the struggle at home. And the reason I see it is because I know it can go the other way. I know that we can also refocus people's idea of what their problem is from the dangers of Russia, China, to the dangers of the employer class in the United States. We're not strong enough to do it now, but we are becoming stronger. It has been done in other countries at other times. It's even been done in this country at certain times. But it has to be kept open as another way you might, to go back to your original question, you might be able to avoid the violence of power politics if you substituted an internal class struggle, which might be a lot less violent than the one that we have now. Look at all the people who will tell you correctly that in terms of the class struggle, Israel and Palestine are not engaged in a class struggle. They're engaged in another kind of struggle. And that has to be understood and respected. It has its own logic, but it isn't the only struggle that people can engage in. People can get focused on something else that's important in their lives. The important thing in the lives of Israelis and Palestinians is not only the struggle between them. There are other issues. Israel is bitterly divided over a whole host of issues. And if I were more knowledgeable about Palestine, my guess is they have their internal issues also. And we have to understand that what happens in society, including violence and war, is shaped by all of the conflicts, not just the ones that are in the newspaper. This system is rendered, ironically, less stable because, for example, of the saber rattling in the South China Sea. Oh my God, we have war with China over Taiwan, blah 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 blah. But that's deep, that's dangerous. But for the people who run this country, that danger is offset because it means Americans see danger over there and don't see the danger right here. They kind of understand a little bit why there might be trouble with China. But no one, with the exception of a few programs like this, explains to them that nothing that happens in Taiwan will affect them as much as the decision today to quadruple the tariff against Chinese electric vehicles. That will impact them, but they don't see it. They don't understand it. There's no movement that says, here's something you can do to fight against that. The Republicans and Democrats are useless because they are both protecting capitalism. And that's what a lot of this is. That whole dimension, you don't get that from John Mearsheimer because he doesn't ask those kinds of questions. Again, no disrespect at all. I look at his videos, I've learned from them, I appreciate what he does.
Whenever they talk about capitalism, they say it's free trade, it's all about competition, it's all about being free to grow. And when it comes to outcome of this system, after many years right now, we see that the outcome of this system is the most important industry right now in the United States that is gaining more than anything else is military industrial complex that is totally defeated in Ukraine. They cannot even outproduce Russia alone. That is a fraction of their budget. How this system was working for the United States and how capable was this system? It was all about the system or a combination of system with politicians.
Let's start with at the beginning of your question, you talk about free trade. And remember, free trade was always an ideal. We never had free trade. The government always interferes in one way or another. And it can't help it. When a government taxes the people or taxes industry, different industries are affected differently by taxes, and consequently, you are intervening. That's why if you get very strict in your libertarian mentality, like Milton Friedman or people like that, they don't even want taxes or a very minimum tax. It's just they want the government not to interfere at all. But the actual notion of a free market, that's always been an ideal. Or to put it in another way, it's been the utopian dimension of bourgeois economics, these ideas of free trade, free market. So it first has to be understood that it was never altogether free or altogether unaffected by governmental interference. The second thing that has to be understood is that minimizing, which is all anybody ever did, minimizing tariffs, minimizing barriers to entry and exit of businesses from industry, and so on, that minimizing that was always in the interest of the most efficient producer of goods and services. Why? Because without government interference, they profit. They win the competition because in that moment, they are the cheapest producer of adequate quality output. So in the 19th century, Britain could become the great advocate of free trade because they were the dominant capitalist economy. In the 20th century, for a while, the United States replaced the British Empire, became itself the most efficient producer, and therefore celebrated free trade. But once the others are better able to manage the free trade for whatever reason. Then you see the British rethinking everything and becoming, you know, protectorate. The British, for example, used their empire to give them special opportunities. A British producer could sell in Australia or South Africa or Canada in a way that a French competitor couldn't. All right. So the whole desire to colonize the world was partly a reaction in case we can't win the competition in the free market, we better have a protected market. What Mr. Biden is doing with tariffs is the same protect your market that the Europeans did with colonies. You know, it's the same enterprise. But here's the irony of capitalism. Your success in closing yourself off from others becomes an incentive for other capitalists to get around it. So to give you an example, if the United States is dominant after World War II, so that the only way for Britain or France or Germany or Italy or Russia or China to have a chance to develop in the world, they have difficulties because of the United States in closing themselves off. Some of them do it. Russia does it using the Soviet system. They are socialists. The Chinese do it. They are communists. What is Western Europe going to do? They can't do that because they depend on the United States for the Marshall Plan to help them grow. And even though the Chinese and the Russians can prevent the United States from directly interfering, if they are going to be becoming no longer the poorest countries in the world, Russia the poorest in Europe, China the poorest on the globe, then they're going to have to succeed in the free market, which is what they did. That's what they did. Russia did it by developing the energy that the more manufacturing successful Western Europeans would need. China did it differently. China, by the way, China did what Japan did after the war. The Japanese and the Chinese both understood, all right, the United States dominates. They can impose free trade, free markets. So we have no choice. The only way forward is for us to outproduce them. We must mobilize capital and labor to produce better quality at a lower price. If we do that, we can become rich and powerful. Japan did it, and then China did it even better. But China learned from Japan, and Japan learned a little from Russia. So it's very important. The Chinese, and by the way, the Europeans did the same thing. The best example is the automobile industry. The Europeans after the war said, how do we compete when American automobiles dominate the world? America dominates. The dollar is the global currency. It's the hegemon. Answer, we have to produce better, cheaper automobiles. And they did. And that's why Americans, the Japanese did the same. And that's why, you know, Ford and General Motors are no longer the dominant force they once were. Toyota is there. Volkswagen is there. And it's a new world because they figured it out. Now, what does the United States do? And this often happens. It could respond by a focused program of developing its own technology, keeping ahead. But the problem is to do that requires concentrated, focused state support and state policy. And here the United States stumbled on its own ideology. It's laissez-faire ideology, the government shouldn't. This was a terrible mistake, not made by Russia, not made by Japan, not made by China. China has had the government in there every minute. Government control, government planning, whole industries owned and operated by the government. That can do what the Chinese did. The United States cannot compete with that unless it gives up the whole ideology, which, by the way, it is doing. All the Republicans who support Biden with these tariffs, and there will be many, they're giving up all that libertarian. It's turning out that ideology has to go because it's impossible to hold on to the commitment of a free trade when you are the country losing the competition in a free trade world. You know who speaks strongest for free trade today? China. And you know why? They're in the position that the United States was, that Britain was before that, and so on. I think that's all that you're seeing is, again, the difficulty for the United States, which doesn't understand that the free trade, laissez-faire ideology of the late 19th and 20th century worked for the United States because we were the dominant economic force. But that approach, globalization, neoliberalism, has now been a disaster because other countries led by China have been better able to use that framework given their governmental involvement than the United States. And that's not going to change because the United States cannot face what the Chinese have accomplished. They just can't. I have to go to seminars where I listen to professors explain to me that the only reason China is growing is because it has a private capitalist sector. Like, you know, that's desperate. That's so desperate. You know, you want to give such a person a hug. It's ridiculous, but it's what they need to hold on. But they don't understand. They're holding on to the policies and framework that failed for them. Just like no one wants to admit that President Biden puts a tariff on Chinese cars because American producers failed to produce that kind of car, that quality and that price. And that's all it is. It's just like when the banks failed in 2008, they called in the government to bail them out. When the competitors of Chinese electric car makers failed, they called in the government. But instead of bailing them out with cash, they put a 100% tariff on the car. Pathetic. The actions of a loser.